And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, we're in the midst of a government shutdown. By some people's reckoning, it began this week. By my reckoning, it began on Inauguration Day when Trump took power, and the first thing he did was start shutting down the government. And I want to get into that. But in any case, what do you think about the shutdown? How do you look at it?
I don't think it's taken its full effect yet, mostly over the weekend. So starting next week, I think you'll start seeing things. And of course, if certain checks don't go out, and as people try to access certain things, one of the things that didn't come out, interestingly, was the labor statistics that were supposed to be out Friday, which would have told us, because there was some indications that job losses were going to be significant on there. And of course, the administration doesn't want that information to come out. And then they're using this as a threat to further enact their Project 2025 agenda. If you notice, the president met with Russell Vought, the person who he basically denied knowing, or right, denied knowing anything about this project during the campaign.
Right.
And
Russell Vought was the man who was in charge of getting the project put together. He oversaw the whole thing.
Right. And this is really sort of the culmination of the 90-year attempt to undo the New Deal.
Right.
It's going back to the 1920s idea of what the federal government should do.
And Russell Vought has a picture of Calvin Coolidge in his office. That is his favorite president.
Yeah, which is essentially do nothing for the people. You know, that's the one thing that the New Deal did. It changed the idea. Prior to that, the idea was essentially the government is there only for essentials. And it wasn't even there for an army, so to speak. Remember, when World War II started, we had one of the smaller armies in the world.
We had no army. What we had was an officer corps and a non-commissioned officer corps, the skeleton of an army that then had to be created around the officer corps.
Yeah, I mean
that was a conscious decision. That was a Calvin Coolidge decision.
Yeah, and actually, it had happened again prior to World War I, where they had to reestablish an army, and then after World War I, they let it go. Standing army was not the usual thing for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, what the New Deal did is it changed the attitudes of people that the government could do things to make your lives easier, to make your lives better.
Mm-hmm.
It could actually help your lives rather than stay out of your life, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And let the chips fall where they may, type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea is, for some reason, was an anathema to generally Republicans. That how dare the government help ordinary people? So they've been fighting it for a long, long time. There was a period probably in the 1950s during, if you listen to Eisenhower's speeches, where they generally conceded that the government could do certain things. And they were doing things, they built the interstate highways, and they began NASA and stuff like that. But we've had this accelerated war on government since the 1980s with the Koch brothers and Grover Norquist, you know, America's for tax reform, where they, the thing about it is, in order to fund a government that could do things for the vast number of people, you had to tax people. And with a progressive tax system, the people at the top had to pay more.
By the way, the word progressive tax, the phrase progressive tax, the word progressive in that phrase has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with the fact that the system is structured so the tax burden progressively increases as the wealth increases. That's what it's about. That's what that word progressive means in the phrase progressive tax. Rich people pay more. Poor people pay less. That's the system. It's progression according to wealth.
Well, it's not just the fact of being rich. It's the fact of making more money.
Yeah, income, right.
It's an income tax,
yeah.
Which we had during the Civil War, and then the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional in post-Civil War times, and then they had to pass, what was it, the 16th Amendment?
16th Amendment, I think the 16th, yeah.
Yeah, the 16th, because 17th is senators, the election
right.
of senators.
Right.
And 18th is prohibition. So, yeah, the 16th Amendment. And don't forget that the tax rate went up to the 90 percentile.
That's right. That's exactly
but there
right.
were very few Americans doing that and making that money.
Right, right.
And there were loopholes and what have you. But
when there was no income tax, it's true that tariffs funded the government. But tariffs couldn't fund the government once the government grew with the various functions that it currently has. And that time, you had to have a different taxation system. The progressive taxation system was what was invented in order to do that. If you don't want to have the progressive taxation system, you cannot have the modern industrial state. Of course, there's no way to pay for it.
Correct. And but they sort of want their cake and eat it too. They don't want to be taxed, but they want their benefits from government. They want to be able to take things.
It is not an accident that every single program for social welfare has been introduced by Democrats. Every single one. From the Roosevelt era onward.
Yeah. Don't forget, there's the regulatory state that grew up during the New Deal and following it is also an anathema. It's part of that. But there's two things that regulators do that, let's put it to you this way, the cheaters don't like. Number one is they hold people accountable for actions that violate the law on things, and they don't like the fact that the government can, you know, can do that, hold them either criminally or through tax, you know, through the IRS system, hold them accountable for stuff. And that's a pretty big deal. That's, you know, on to a certain extent, that's one half of it. The other half of the coin is they make regulations that protect people. And by doing that, they increase costs. It costs money for safety. And they don't like that either. They want to be able to do things in the quickest, cheapest manner. And their view of things tends to be that people are liabilities, not assets to your company.
Well, I think you're making it a very important point. And the point about regulations is that they're always aimed at corporations. And the owners of corporations therefore claim that their liberties are being infringed, their freedom is being restricted. And that's exactly right. They're telling the truth. their freedom to exploit, their freedom to adulterate, their freedom to poison, their freedom to do whatever they feel like doing in the interest of maximizing their profits is ended. They are subjected to regulation. And therefore, from the viewpoint of the worker or the consumer, what is the restriction of freedom on the corporation, regulations, is freedom for the consumer and for the worker, because they are then freed from the worry of pollution, from the worry of super exploitation, from the worry of anti-safe or unsafe working conditions, and so forth and so on. So this is a question of which side of the fence you're on. Both sides are true, viewed from each side's side. But there are not, but you know, there are, of the 330 million Americans, 300 million are consumers and workers.
Right. Now, I mentioned that we've had this 90-year war on the New Deal, but for the last 40 to 50 years, essentially the Milton Friedman, Ronald Reagan ideas about government have accelerated this or been trying to be pushed on this. Remember, Milton Friedman's main idea is that corporations are there solely to maximize profits for the shareholder. And everything else doesn't matter. The stakeholders, employees in particular, or consumers, are not the ones that they should care about.
That's right, because the market is self-correcting. The market does, in the end, what's good. But as it happens,
that's not true.
People keep statistics, and it turns out, yeah, it's false. That's false. There is no such thing as a market that's free and that is also efficient. There are no such thing as efficient markets, neither in terms of health nor even in terms of profitability.
Which is another reason that they don't want to keep the statistics.
Right, exactly. Don't count.
They have the statistics. Yeah. They don't want people to know about them.
That's right. And by the way, you notice that the guy that Trump picked to take over the Bureau of Labor Statistics was dropped last week because he's so egregiously reactionary and said so many things that are so embarrassing to the people who appointed him, mainly the Trumpists, that they couldn't maintain his nomination.
Yeah.
Where did he go back to? He went back to the Heritage Society, authors of Project 2025.
Yeah, you remember my famous admonition that all roads lead to it from the Koch brothers, main founders of these groups.
That's right.
And so that's, and now, of course, with the push to AI, what they're trying to do, of course, is to get rid of workers.
And maybe they'll succeed. They may succeed.
Yeah. I mean,
but then which robot do you have you heard about that is a consumer?
Well, that's the whole thing. And, you know, you get that argument. You get that argument that by unionizing, that they're just accelerating the push by the owners to get rid of people because you don't have, you know, you won't have to pay the benefits that unions stand for.
But the fact of the matter is,
if they could get rid of them, they'd get rid of them anyway.
Right.
There's a thing here in I'm in Philadelphia this weekend, and they closed down a bunch of Starbucks downtown. Now, if you've gone to any city or gone anywhere, you know that Starbucks are ubiquitous everywhere, and you couldn't walk through Center City without going past at least two, three, or more of them. And they closed down six of them. They closed down the closest one to my daughter's apartment that we used to go to. And my daughter told me that the ones that they closed down happened to be the ones that voted for unionization.
Shock. What a shock.
Which is a shock. I mean, my reply should be that all the others should then unionize and see if Starbucks wants to pull out of Philadelphia entirely.
Yeah.
So we're stuck with Dunkin' Donuts, which isn't a bad way to go. But we were there this weekend, and my wife said something to the guy. You know, I used to go to Starbucks to get this. And he said, well, the Starbucks died, actually. They killed it. It didn't die. They killed it.
Well, there's a chain that apparently is starting up in the United States, a Chinese coffee chain, which actually doesn't have workers, or has,
Very
basically
few.
very, very, very few. You can't place your order in the shop. You have to order it online. You come into the shop to pick it up, and you leave. There's no place to sit. And it is the largest coffee shop in the world, a coffee chain in the world.
But don't forget now, the price of coffee is going up and up and up.
Right.
Part because of climate change, but in large part because of the tariffs.
Well,
Well,
the tariffs are 50 to
the number one supplier was Brazil, wasn't
Brazil, right? 50% tariff now.
it? Yeah, and Donald Trump's against that. So people are starting to see it. And I've gotten the sense that finally, the increased costs that the tariffs have brought are starting to kick in. You're starting to see a fall off in people spending money. We were in a restaurant the other night up in our area, and we were the only people there. We've been there before on a number of occasions, and there's always, a bunch of tables that are being served. We were there, and the whole time we were there, no one else came in.
Really, really.
With my daughter, we went out. Actually, it was started at happy hour. It was a really interesting restaurant. It was good food, but they were not packed. They were not full. They had a lot of tables. People were kind of drifting in, but not as what you would expect at the time on a Friday afternoon after work that you would see people. I'm starting to, that's a very unscientific way, but it could be something. So gonna have to see on that. So that's our. And as far as the shutdown, the Republicans are still on the messages to the Democrats. It's the Democrats, but Democrats have two strong messages. Number one is that the Republicans have been in charge of this whole government since January.
That's right.
If you couldn't get this thing passed, it's your fault, not ours. And number two is what the Democrats are holding out for on the health care, because those health care bills are starting to come out. And you're starting to see the costs being enormous in terms of increases or projected increases. And that never really works for the Republicans. But when you're ideological about this, and with this administration, they may be willing to go down with the ship. Who knows? But of course, we're on that ship too.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, so let me ask you now another question connected to all this. What's your attitude toward the Hegseth meeting of with the generals? What do you think that was all about?
Well, that's all in line with what we've seen. The Trump administration, in a broader sense, views itself as only being an administration for MAGA and for its rich donors. That's it. And this was just trying to reinforce MAGA ideas on the base. And what they were, what he was, Hegseth was trying to do. Of course, he has a personal reason. He's been sort of on the sh on the list of first cabinet person to leave the administration because of his blunders and incompetence. But so he's trying. He was trying to put on a show that would please the boss, as they all do. So he was doing that. But his view of the United States military is the view of sort of before Harry Truman integrated it after World War II. Get rid of women, get rid of as many blacks as you can. Not directly, but his idea about having no beards. And we know that a lot of black service people wear men wear beards because of their skin conditions and the way their hair, their facial hair interacts with that. He doesn't take that, you know, consideration at all. And his view is that, you know, this warrior mentality, so to speak, that it's hand-to-hand combat that runs the military now. And it isn't. It's high tech. You still need infantry. You still need people who know how to shoot. But women can shoot guns too. And I'm reminded of Tammy Duckworth, the senator from Illinois, who had both legs blown off during her time of service. She wears artificial legs. She was a helicopter pilot. You know, a woman could run a helicopter just as well as a man. And people who are running drones now from thousands of miles away, you don't have to be able to do 50 pull-ups to do that. You have to have good eyesight. And the other irony is, you know, he's trying to reinforce this DEI idea of that all blacks and all women are only there because we've got reduced standards. But in many ways, Pete Hegseth is a DEI hire. And no one else, you know, would have hired him prior to this, and probably not after him, someone as incompetent as he is. He's the guy who got the break, not the women who are serving, or the African Americans who are serving.
I think that aside from his incompetence, his message is an important message. His message was a call for a fascist military, a military that is based on brutality, which makes a cultural norm of brutality, and which exists to exert brutality. He says, you're here to kill and break things. In that situation, there are no rules. There is just victory, and the most brutal is the best. It's a vision of Rambo as the cultural, you know, icon. And that is, the cult of brutality is a characteristic cultural feature of all fascist regimes. The breaking all ethical norms, whether these norms arise from humanism or from religion, is a standard ideological trope of all fascist ideologies. In Mussolini's day, there was a famous quote, his son-in-law, who was a high official in the fascist government, was quoted as saying, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my revolver. And that is precisely what Hegseth was emulating in his rather insane speech. The truth of the matter is, armies and armed forces don't exist to kill the enemy, which is what Hegseth says they're there for. Armies and armed forces exist to subdue the enemy, to make the enemy surrender, to make the enemy ineffective. But you don't have to kill him to do that. In fact, the most significant military theorists in the world are people who write about how the military can win without fighting. Sun Tzu, the Chinese military.
The art of war.
That's the art of war. That's right. Indirect warfare. If to follow Hegseth, the only fighting that makes sense is straight ahead into the enemy fire. Beat the shit out of them and knock them and kill them and take whatever casualties you want and be man enough to do that, which means no indirect warfare tactically, which means no diplomacy, which means just mass murder.
Well, the other thing is fear that they're trying to instill on people who they don't favor, so to speak, to subdue with fear. But fear is not the best way of winning. Fear builds resentment.
That's right. Fear unites your opponent.
Yeah.
It's true. Fear disarms the people who are fearful. But guess what? Not everybody's fearful. And that minority that is not fearful becomes more determined to get rid of you because you are a fearsome type. You're a dangerous human.
Yeah. But and that's what Trump is trying to do on the civil side also, is instill fear. You know,
But that's the mafia technique.
If you don't accede to me, I'm going to punish you. This is his retribution campaign against individuals. And it's his retribution campaign against places that did not vote for him. This week where he's cutting out monies that have been appropriated for blue cities or blue states, Chicago or California. And he's essentially said to people in those areas who have voted for him, the hell with you. I don't care that I have supporters there. I'm just going to, destroy the people who are organized against me and who voted against me. And it's not, in the long run, it's not the best tactic, to say the least. But he's trying.
Even in the short run, it's not the best.
he's trying it. Yeah. And, where people had things or had, can see things not happening, so to speak. If the Democrats have to be able to exploit that, point out, it could have been better if we, if he had let us do this. Remember the tunnel that Chris Christie refused to fund? I mean, how much better off would the people of New York and New Jersey been if that tunnel had gone through during his...
It's not only the people of New York and New Jersey. That tunnel was necessary and is still necessary to open up the port and get stuff moving out of this congested port into the hinterland. As it stands, there's an enormous delay and cost increase because there's just not enough transportation link to get stuff out of the port into the hinterland where it needs to go to be distributed for whatever the reason is. Yeah. And just last week, Trump, through Sean Murphy, the transportation secretary, pulled another $18 billion away from New York, which was to half of which was to be used for this tunnel. New York isn't benefiting from the tunnel. It just happens that the tunnel is there, but that's where the port is.
Yeah, it's the logic of it or the effects of it are just there's a cost, and people are going to eventually see the cost. Although you don't know if you don't have something, you don't know how good it could be. And again, that's back to the idea where we started with the government. If you don't have it,
you may not miss it.
You may not miss it, type of thing.
But it's up to the Democrats, right? They're the opposition party, to point this out. I don't know that they're doing it. I know that's fighting on health care.
Yes.
But the fact is the government's been shut down since January 6th. And with increasing, the discretionary budget, which is really all of the social welfare programs that the government runs, totals about $1 trillion. And the cuts, the Trump cuts to the discretionary budget so far and their clawbacks is nearly 70% of that. 70%. In effect, he's just about shut down the government insofar as government programs that are intended to benefit workers and consumers are concerned. The non-discretionary budget, which is basically the amount of money you need to pay interest, that didn't get touched. But the programs, they all have been cut. So anybody who says they're just shutting down the government hasn't been paying attention. He's been in power nearly 9 months, and he's been shutting the government down right and left for 9 months. It is not a Democratic Party problem. This is a Republican Party program.
We'll have to see where it goes.
We'll see where it goes. But it won't be good. No. We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.